We are not entering a new era. We are in it. A time in which we begin more and more to understand the deep connection between all things. With 40% of all Americans now exploring natural medicine, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association, it is apparent that the easiest way Americans recognize holism is through medicine. Dr. Larry Dossey is a medical doctor, but he is now a proponent of holistic medicine. In his new book, Reinventing Medicine, Beyond Mind-Body to a New Era in Healing, Larry Dossey talks about how the new era of medicine we are already in is characterized by the notion that the mind is not confined to the brain, or to the body for that matter, but is of a nature he calls non-local.
Non-local mind is mind that is not localized to the individual brain and body, or even to the present moment. Non-local mind is infinite mind. It's mind that's spread throughout space and time without boundaries and without interruption. And if you follow the logic of what this mind would look like, it would unite with other minds, which are also not localizable. I mean, there are no boundaries. You can't put them in boxes and wall them off from all other consciousnesses.
While the mainstream media might characterize interest in such paranormal notions as far out or somewhat goofy, Dr. Dossey is quick to point out a study done by a respected institution that suggests the opposite is true.
But the National Opinions Research Center, so-called NORC, from the University of Chicago, actually did psychological evaluations on people who had these radical, far-out parapsychological experiences, such as the sense of being bathed in white light and being connected with all there is. And they found that having these experiences was the best predictor of solid, normal mental health of any criterion they had ever discovered. So far from being an indicator of mental ill health, having these paranormal experiences is an indicator of normal psychological health.
Dr. Larry Dossey is like a beacon in the murky night of mechanistic medicine, pointing the way to a future that is already here. It is our pleasure to provide a forum for his thoughts and visions, which is coming right up. I hope you enjoy today's program. Thanks for tuning in. The interview with Dr. Larry Dossey originally aired in October of 99 and will begin in just a moment. As we head into the 21st century and the third millennium, one would think that everyone in our culture is stricken with panic at the thought. The bumper stickers of Christians that say, in case of rapture, this car will be unmanned, are one sign. The media, plagued by what Rion Eisler calls disempathitis, doesn't help either. She suggests the media is sick and as a result concentrates on the sickest aspects of society. The hurricanes, floods, wars, premillennial shooting sprees, and other tragedies. If it bleeds, it leads. With all this background cultural blur, you would think the next century will be hell. However, if you pay attention, you can find signs that the 21st century promises to have profound change that has been due for a long, long time. In no other discipline will the change be as profound as in the wellness profession. According to a Journal of the American Medical Association survey, 40% of all Americans are seeking some kind of, quote, alternative care, unquote. I prefer the term natural medicine, but we'll go along with the term alternative for now. 40% of all Americans, and most of those folks, do not tell their doctors about their decision to seek an alternative practitioner. Why? Well, you'll probably get an arrogant response like I once did. Something like, well, it probably won't hurt you. Old paradigms die hard amidst a lot of fear. But there are also leaders, trailblazers who aren't afraid to admit that what they once believed is wrong and there is a better way. Today's guest is one such man. Dr. Larry Dossey graduated with honors from the University of Texas at Austin, earned his medical degree at Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. He was decorated for valor for his service as a battalion surgeon in Vietnam, and all this experience did not prepare him for his life's work, writing about the future of medicine. Well, then again, perhaps it did. His book on the healing capabilities of prayer, Healing Words, was a bestseller, and his latest book is Reinventing Medicine, Beyond Mind-Body to a New Era in Healing. Dr. Larry Dossey, welcome back to the Pacific Northwest.
Paul, it's great to be on your show again. Thanks.
You got it. You know, before your last book was published in 1993, Healing Words, there were only three medical schools in the U.S. that had courses devoted to exploring the role of religious practice or prayer or spirituality in healing. And now there are nearly 60. And this is the sweetest revenge, isn't it?
Well, it is a kind of a revenge. And I'm glad to have lived long enough to see this being carried into the medical schools. You know, this is the desire, I think, and the wish and the fondest hope of every researcher and writer to see your work accepted in your own profession. And that's a wonderful feeling for me.
Yeah. And yet, you know, you say you have this feeling during your lifetime, yet the change is happening very, very quickly, isn't it?
I was terrifically wrong about the speed of this process. I thought that this was going to take somewhere into the middle of the next century for this data and this evidence to be accepted and implemented in actual institutions such as medical schools and hospitals, but I was dead wrong. I really can't keep up with all the programs that are embracing this that are cropping up at medical schools and hospitals around the country.
And that's pretty much what you do. You are no longer practicing, but you're combing through all the research that's being done on the paranormal or distant healing or non-local mind terms that we'll get into as we go along.
Right. My job seems to have evolved into offering my services as a kind of an interpreter of this data for my colleagues in the profession, a kind of synthesizer and collector of the evidence. Before Healing Words came out in 93, no one had ever really brought together all of these studies, for example, on distant intercessory prayer in one place and examined them very thoroughly. And so I think there is a role that's valuable that's to be played in that way.
And someone with a pedigree like yours. I mean, MD, that's first of all right there. If it was ND or DC, they'd say, well, wait a second, this is not the case. But you're a medical doctor who even served his country in Vietnam. You know, I didn't know that before.
Yeah, I had my go at that in 69. I spent a year with the 173rd Airborne Brigade, which was a bunch of paratroopers, wild and crazy young warriors who I was assigned to for a year.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, this is a good segue from war, from one war to another, because wars have so much to do with our understanding of how the body works. In fact, you break down medical eras into three, era one, two, and three, the latest which we've just entered. The first, which started right about the time of the Civil War. So maybe a summary of these different eras of medicine and pretty much what they stand for.
Well, the era approach is kind of a framework I've invented to sort of explain the transformations we've lived through in healing approaches in the past 150 years. Era one did begin in the decade of the American Civil War, 1860s. This was when medicine first began to become scientific. Actually, it's evolved into the use of drugs and surgical procedures, basically.
And we're just what we still have now, isn't
it? I know,
it?
It's still with us. And, you know, obviously it dominates medicine. But beginning in the 1950s, Paul, another decisive development began to occur. And when I was in medical school, this was called psychosomatic disease. We emphasized the negative.
Uh-huh.
But now this is being called mind-body medicine, and there's a positive role we acknowledge now that the role can play. For example, the role of imagery and visualization and meditation on your own body. These are healthful, positive effects. But I think we're living now into what I call Era 3, which is what this book, Reinventing Medicine, addresses. And this is the capacity of some quality of the mind to affect not just your body, that's Era 2, mind-body medicine, but the ability of consciousness to reach out beyond the confines of our brains and bodies and even the present moment to make a difference out there in the world. I'm absolutely fascinated by the health implications of this, and I know this strikes people who encounter it for the first time as somewhat outrageous, but I would defend it, Paul, on the basis of a little four-letter word, data.
Yeah,
evidence.
Lots of it in the book. You know, one more thought about the difference between allopathic, symptom-oriented medicine and natural medicine is the notion of pathologizing or mythologizing. You know, I mean, if I were 20 years younger, I would have been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, put on Ritalin, probably against my better judgment, and made to think that I'm a statistic. Whereas when you look at ADD's positive side, the notion of I can think about what next question I'm going to ask, I can think about how the tape is going and if it's getting all the information right, I can think about all these different little things, how my dog is reacting in the other room hearing my voice and making sure he's not going to bark and ruin the interview. thousands of little things at a very low level of consciousness, and yet the old way of looking at it is to look at the negative side, to pathologize it.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting to look through the history, the annals of science, and to look at figures who popped up historically. Einstein is a great example. If Einstein came along today and revealed to his physician or psychiatrist, if he would have had one, everything he thought and dreamt about, he would be classified almost certainly as schizophrenic and probably medicated into some sort of unimaginative individual. So I, you know, other people have written about this and proposed this. What are we doing by pathologizing these strange mental states that we really don't understand that sometimes erupt in enormous expressions of creativity and discovery?
We're doing a disservice, aren't we?
I think so, and we ought to rethink this.
Like, for example, Prozac. I was just listening to an interview I did with an alchemist, Dennis Houck, last night. And, you know, the notion of when someone gets depressed, we put them on Prozac and we prevent them from going through that depression, experiencing it, and coming out better and greater and getting rid of all that dross that's not serving them anymore.
That's right. You know, surveys have been done looking at great artists, poets, and particularly musicians who have often these incredible swings in their states of consciousness and so on. And if all of these people had been Prozac'd, then one wonders what we would have lost in terms of these incredibly contributory creative geniuses. So we have to rethink whether or not it's valuable to smooth out everyone into some sort of, you know, bottom line state of consciousness. I think not.
Lowest common denominator.
Lowest common denominator.
Yeah. Dr. Larry Dossey is our guest. His new book is Reinventing Medicine, Beyond Mind, Body to a New Era in Healing. I'm Paul Nelson. The book is brilliant from the very first quote. As soon as I saw that, I thought, there is something here. And the quote is, "Where does one person end and another begin?" That's attributed to Iris Murdoch. Now, that's really the key to the book and to the concept of non-local mind. But the genesis of the book itself is about a dream you had, a prophetic dream, which also gets into the concept of non-local mind. Why don't you tell us about that experience?
Well, this dream happened to me when I first entered medicine. This was during the first year I was practicing internal medicine in Dallas. And I have to say, I've been very hesitant to write about this. This is the first time I've ever divulged this publicly in this book. And so it took me, Paul, over 20 years to get enough courage to go public with this. So I'm really, you know, I can't really crow about this. I was really in denial about the significance of this for an awful long time. But in any case, during my first year in medical practice, I had a dream about the four-year-old son of one of my cardiology colleagues that I was in practice with at the time. And in this dream, this kid was in an examination room, and he was lying on his back, and a medical technician was trying to do something to his head. And this wasn't working because the kid was not cooperating. In fact, he was going berserk. His mother was standing there trying to comfort him, but this wasn't helping either. Finally, the medical technician got so exasperated, she threw up her hands, said, "I quit," turned around, and stormed out. That was the dream. This had a feeling of incredible reality to me. This was one of those numinous, realer-than-real dreams. I forgot about it, however, because I thought it was trivial and just one of those crazy dreams, until I was sitting at lunch that same morning in the luncheon area of our medical complex, having lunch with the father of this kid in the dream, the cardiologist. And while we were talking, in walks his wife carrying this kid. And this kid is really upset. He's got big old tears coming down his cheeks. His head is wet. He's really upset. She begins to relate what had happened. They've just come from the EEG laboratory where they shampoo your head and put all the electrodes on when they do a brainwave tracing. This kid wouldn't allow it. He went nuts. They had to abandon the procedure. What had happened is that the day before, the kid had had a fever and a seizure, and so they had decided today to bring him into the laboratory for this EEG tracing. I was stunned when I heard her tell this tale because I had dreamt in precise, exotic detail these events before they had even happened. So after she left with this boy, I asked the father, you know, we need to talk. You know, could I have known about this ahead of time? And he said, "Don't be silly." So I told him my dream, and he turned white. And now there were two of us physicians sitting there having this existential crisis, you know, because we knew that if we took this seriously, space and time just didn't operate the way we'd been taught.
You were probably thinking somewhere deep down inside, it's going to be 20 years before I could start telling people about this, before the scientific community to catch up to where you were.
Well, listen, I'd known patients who had been put on medication for talking about experiences like this. I mean, I wasn't about to go public with this kind of experience. But the universe sort of kept hammering at me, because within the space of 1 month, I had two more of these suckers. And I got the message, you know, something needs to be redefined here for me. But it took me a long time to come to terms with this.
And no dreams like that since?
Nope. Wow. It was like the universe had delivered the message and hung up the phone. And now it was up to me to figure out what this meant, you know, if I could.
That's a great metaphor. So with that, we get to the notion of non-local mind. Where does one person end and another begin? So what is the thumbnail description of non-local mind?
Well, non-local mind is mind that is not localized to the individual brain and body, or even to the present moment. Non-local mind is infinite mind. It's mind that's spread throughout space and time without boundaries and without interruption. And if you follow the logic of what this mind would look like, it would unite with other minds, which are also not localizable. I mean, there are no boundaries. You can't put them in boxes and wall them off from all other consciousnesses. This is an ancient realization. And who would have thought that data, evidence from modern science would be confirming this point of view? But I think that's really what is happening currently. I believe this is the model of consciousness that's going to carry us into the next millennium.
Wow, that's a heavy quote there, and I'm with you on that. That's part of why you're on the show. And, you know, you're talking about the research, and I think we need to really get into some of that, because you've done so much of it. It'd be a disservice not to talk about at least two or three of the studies. And not just, you know, we could see here in a place like Seattle, maybe the Bastyr University doing this kind of stuff, but we're not talking about a naturopathic college necessarily doing this research, although they are doing their own research. But there are many prestigious medical schools that are doing studies on non-local mind, prayer and medicine, distant healing, and other fascinating aspects of what you're calling Era 3 medicine. Duke, Princeton. There's a great study done at San Francisco General by Dr. Randolph Bird in 1988 that you call the most famous study in distant healing. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it has come down, I think it's safe to say, as the most illustrious study of all. It's certainly not the best study. It could have been improved on, but it certainly established a principle that you could evaluate and study distant healing, intercessory prayer, just pretty much like you would a new medication. What Bird did was to take 393 patients who came through the coronary care unit of San Francisco General Hospital, and half of these people were prayed for and half weren't. Otherwise, they were all given equivalent high-tech care, state-of-the-art medicine, and he simply saw how they did. There were fewer people in the prayed-for group who died. The people who received the prayer, none of them had to have the tube put down the throat and be hooked up to the mechanical ventilator, while in the unprayed-for group, 12 people had to have that done. There were many measures of superiority in the prayed-for group, so that I think it's safe to say that if what was being evaluated here had not been prayer but a new medication, this probably would have been heralded as a medical breakthrough. For me, this was a stunning discovery, because it showed that you could empirically test distant healing, the effects of people's distant thoughts on other individuals who don't even know that they're being prayed for. This, for me, was a stunning discovery.
And it comes to the notion of Keats, who talked about negative capability, the notion of being comfortable to embody paradox. And when we look at Randolph Bird, a very devout religious man who couldn't reconcile his religious side with the scientific side until this one experiment that led to, or his one experience that led to this experiment.
Well, that's a tragedy, I think, that is implicit in modern science, and particularly modern medicine. You know, most of us who go through medical school are obsessed with this idea that you've got to make a choice in life, and you can either decide to be scientific and rational and intellectual and analytical, or you can go over and do something at the College of Arts and Sciences, right? You can be intuitive and irrational and creative and artistic and flaky. And you can't get those two impulses together in your life. And so we're told that, you know, boys, you can't have it both ways. You know, life is this painful choice. This is a schizophrenic division in people's lives. I think this evidence that we're talking about here shows that we can have it both ways. We can bring our intuitive and creative and spiritual side together and marry it up with our intellectual and scientific side. I think that's a direct implication of these studies.
Not only can we do it, but we ought to do it, and it's going to happen anyway. I mean, it looks to me that this is an outgrowth of, you can go back to Newton, you can go back even further. In fact, in the beginning of the book, you go back further than that, talking about Plato and Aristotle and the notion of reason. And you didn't get into this specifically, but how reason started to replace mythology, and that's where we started going wrong.
You know, you can see, if you go back to the way the Greek physicians reacted, for example, to dreams, which I did in the book, you can see how there was a period in Western healing traditions where doctors didn't split up this mind-body business, you know. And they, for example, in the Asclepions in ancient Greece, the healing temples, the doctors would go to the patients at night and they'd whisper in their ear, pay attention to your dreams. Pray for a revelation that we'll understand the diagnosis and maybe even the therapy will come to you in the dream. So I think we're reasoning our way slowly back to this piece of wisdom, and that's one reason I call this reinventing medicine. You know, we're trying to rediscover some of this ancient wisdom.
Yeah, and as we get to the end of our first interview here, I think it'd be important to talk about some of the criticism of non-local mind. In fact, some of the critics are very well-respected people. Nobel laureate Francis Crick, who was there in the 1950s, sharing a Nobel Prize for the discovery of the nature of the DNA molecule, the double helix. He's a critic of non-local mind.
That's right. Crick is, I think, committed to the idea that everything that happens in terms of mental activity is just a function of what the molecules and the atoms in the brain, basically the brain chemistry, is doing. I think Professor Crick is not very well informed about the evidence, particularly in medicine, that points to an infinite non-local expression of consciousness. And this is important because most of the theorists these days in the hard sciences who are talking about the nature of consciousness are horribly informed about the clinical expressions of this in hospitals and clinics and so on. And this is one reason why I think the great advances in our understanding of consciousness are not going to come out of thought labs and computer tanks. I just think that it's going to come out of the medical side of things, where we see these non-local expressions day in and day out being played out in the lives of our patients.
And quite often women are going to be there who are perhaps more open to that kind of thing happening.
I think that's right, and the fact that in many medical schools, more than half the student body now is made up of women, I think is going to help this process along.
Amen. Now, when we talk about critics of non-local mind, we're talking about people who have egos that refuse to relinquish control. Basically, we're telling people, Francis, you know, you're a very brilliant man, you want a Nobel Prize, but you're wrong, and he's not willing to admit that.
You know, there's an old saying, Paul, that comes as consolation to me when we get into these knockdown, drag-out contests and arguments with people, you know, for example, who have won a prize, a Nobel Prize in one area of science, but and claim to extend this knowledge into fields they really are not informed about. Max Planck, the physicist who was involved in the transformation in physics at the turn of this century, said once, "Science changes funeral by funeral." And I think sometimes that, you know, we're just going to have to be patient, and the many of the critics are just going to die off. They're going to go to their grave horribly uninformed, certain that the rest of us are fools.
And when they come back, they'll get it. I'll leave you with a quote from a guy from your home state, Sam Rayburn, who once said, "It takes a carpenter to build a barn, but any jackass can knock it down." So there you have it. Larry Dossey. Thank you, Larry. That's it for interview number one, and we'll be back with more with Larry Dossey. Dr. Larry Dossey is the author of Reinventing Medicine, Beyond Mind, Body to a New Era in Healing. And he's got a website, www.dosseydossey.com.
Right.
That's two Dosseys, Dosseydossey.com.